welcome to A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk into a Bar,
the podcast where we mix a sometimes weird but always delicious cocktail of theology, philosophy, and spirituality. Welcome, everyone, to A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk into a Bar. We're going to be discussing something today that is pretty important to both of us and something that we've talked about having an episode on in the future, and now is that time. So we're both pretty excited about this. Our topic today is truth, the philosophical perspective and the pastoral perspective on truth. So it's going to be heady. It's going to be nerdy. Buckle your seatbelts. It's going to be a good time.
Fun times. Well, we have a really wonderful beverage in front of us that I'd love to talk about, sample. I've been wanting to sample this. So
let's do it.
Today we have Four Roses Single Batch Select. This is Four Roses. I believe this is their top offering. Retails for about $60 or $70, and it's a high proof. I'm not going to say hot because I haven't tried it yet, but it's a high cut. What's the
52%?
52%. So that's on the higher end of the spectrum. And Four Roses says that they use two different mash bills and five different yeast strains to create 10 unique bourbon recipes. And of those recipes, six are blended together to make this the Small Batch Select. So it's basically just a blend of a bunch of their best stuff that they sample, and they think this is their idea of the best they've got.
All right, let's see if they're right about that.
The look of it is really gorgeous. It's dark, caramely colored. Mm-hmm. It's sticking to the, there's a word for this, but I don't know it, but it's sticking
legs.
It's got great legs. I mean, it's sticking to the side of our glasses like nobody's business. Really good. I'm smelling it, which I always do first.
Yeah. You can hold it back a little further to smell this one. It you don't have to get it up in there.
Mm, that's complex, though. Mm-hmm. That the nose of it, at least.
Yeah, floral, delicious.
Spicy, oaky.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa, man. I like that.
It's not very often I get knocked back by a bourbon. That's delicious. Mm-hmm.
That's really good.
Yeah, it's nice. Caramel, pepper.
It's, I mean, for me, the main word for it is complex. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've just tried some bourbons and whiskeys that are just straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
Couple notes, but almost single note. This is on the opposite end of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little hot, so you got to, you know, exhale a little bit, get ready for it, but because mm-hmm. of the alcohol content, but man, there's so much going on there. Now I'm getting like apples, like fall fruit. Mm. Like it brings the brighter berry stuff in some, but now I'm getting that deep, dark, almost tart apple.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's something fresh about it. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
One of the tasting notes I read, which I don't get, but it was like spearmint gum.
Interesting.
I don't quite see that.
Kind of wish you hadn't said that.
But yeah, there's like, something, I don't know.
Yeah.
I do love, though, when, you know, you'll read reviews and they'll talk about the flavor profiles, and then you taste it yourself, and sometimes that helps.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes they'll say something like spearmint gum, which I can respect a person who tastes spearmint gum in something, in a bourbon, but I completely don't understand that.
Yeah.
But that's also fun, that you can taste the same thing and taste so many different things.
Mm-hmm. It's probably just the coolness of all of the alcohol evaporating. Like that's,
I mean, booze.
That's what that is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. There's not, see, and my new bourbons, I either don't like the finish, or I don't like the start of it, but I like the finish, or opposite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's no bad experience in this.
It's solid all the way through. Not mm-hmm. a long finish, but satisfying.
It's rich. It's got a kind of rich mouthfeel to it,
mm-hmm.
and that depth of flavor brings, like...
really deep, woody flavors. It's like
yeah.
allspice and clove.
Yes.
Like it,
mm-hmm.
finishes
like
off with some of that
glass.
Like, yep, finishes off with some of that library leather note.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm. This is
one I would add a few drops of water to.
Is it?
If I had some.
I got some right there.
Maybe I will.
I'm tempted to add some water to it because I'd be interested to know what it does, but I almost don't want to because I like so much what I'm tasting right now.
What do you think? Should I add some water?
Definitely brings the pepper out more. I don't know if it improved it, actually. I kind of like the mm-hmm.
yeah, I'm not going to do it
the first time.
I like this a lot. Yeah, and if you're noticing, friends, that we got a little quiet. I feel like beer brings out some fun times. Bourbon makes things serious. Yeah. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Whiskey's contemplative.
It's like
reading a book, but silently, like in the corner by yourself.
Well, and you got to actually like start turning inward if you're going to start naming some of these flavors and and articulate the experience. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, friends, Four Roses, Small Batch Select. This is one that, for me, 60 or 70 is like way high on what I would spend on a whiskey. Mm-hmm. This is one that I'll put on my shelf and only bring it out for the special occasions because this is good stuff.
You said this one could go on my shelf.
Is that what I said?
I think so.
My shelves are all full.
You heard him say that, right?
I mean, my man from Story Hill BKC hand-delivered it to me, so we'll see about that.
Well, thank Joe for us. This is really awesome.
Yeah, really good. Well, cheers. So one of the main things that I've observed in the course of our young podcast here is the way that we think about truth, and by we, I mean me and Kyle primarily, but Elliot and I and Kyle, the way we think about truth, the way we talk about truth, how we hold that word and that idea is quite different. And it's different in a way that I really enjoy. I really enjoy being challenged and pushed and being forced and challenged to critically think about what I kind of take for granted. And I really enjoy it around truth because I've, to be honest with you, I've been uncomfortable for a long time with how many Christians and Christian leaders throw around this word truth just like it's, you know, just on the tip of their tongue all the time. And like they have the corner on the market of truth. It drives me crazy, to be honest, a little bit. And as you talk about truth, Kyle, I've really enjoyed it. And you always say, we'll save this for another episode. We'll save that for another episode. Here we are. I'm excited to hear about what your idea of truth, what philosophers think of when they think of the word truth and the concept, and what are our options, what's attainable, what's just a nonsensical way to talk about it. Because again, when you hear Christians talking about truth, it's usually in regard to sexuality. Well, we know truth, or whether it's science and creationism, we know truth. Or Christians will refer to the scriptures as truth, absolute truth even sometimes, right?
Yeah.
The scriptures. That's problematic for me, and I'm a pastor, for crying out loud. I have issues with that. So I think philosophy is helpful in that it seems like philosophers are able to take a very objective view of something like truth. You have as few ulterior motives, much less, I would say, than most Christian leaders. Can we say that?
Or at least we're very intentional about making our motives clear when they're present, and
building
the method so that the motives are either left out, or at least the problematic aspects of them are left out, or so that they're incorporated but in an intentional way. I'll say that.
Yeah. And I would just to, you know, burst your bubble a little bit, Kyle, and whatever philosophers, other philosophers are out there listening. Yeah, I mean, you can be kind of arrogant about this idea of truth, right? Which, I mean, philosophers can be arrogant about a lot of things, let's be honest. Mm-hmm. But
I mean, have you ever read Plato? I mean, Socrates was the most arrogant bastard in the world.
I mean, just the question, have you ever read Plato, is kind of arrogant right off the bat from the jump. but do you guys know what I'm talking about when I say how Christians toss around the word truth? Like it's kind of a weapon, or like they have the full market on that word, concept, idea.
Yeah. So as the one in the room who's studied this the least, I think maybe if I talk more experientially, just when I think about truth, like what that means to me. And I realized in knowing we were going to talk about this today, I was thinking, like, what is truth and how do I relate to it? And I realized I've had this increasingly complex relationship with truth, because belief in something as true gives us, that's what creates the platform from which you can critique or reject things other than that as untrue or false. So I guess that's one option. We can reject them as false in this kind of active, confrontational way. And this is a lot of my context and history is around this very moralistic focus. Like you said, we've cornered the market on truth, and this is ours. And so there's that, or you have to be okay to just live in this unresolved space where
I say something's true and you say that something else is true, and we're just not going to resolve that. Mm-hmm. Which I guess is okay.
Sounds like the world we live in.
Yeah. Or then there's this concept of like, there's your truth and there's my truth, and mm-hmm. we all have our truth. Mm-hmm. And I just can't really wrap my head around that. It feels, mm-hmm. I like that, but I don't, it doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I guess where I've landed is I've been wrong enough times, and I've been assertive about what is true enough times to get myself in trouble to where, okay, so now I'm not going to do that anymore. I still see certain things as true, but the scope of what I'm willing to actually argue about is much less because I know I've changed my mind on stuff that I used to think was really core to who I am. And so mm-hmm. I don't know what I'm going to believe next week or 5 years from now beyond mm-hmm. a very narrow set of things that I would say are actually true. And even in those, I'm going to be hesitant to try to mm-hmm. impose that on anybody else, which yep. creates conflicts in me around things, concepts like sharing my faith or trying to spread the gospel and scare quotes, whatever that means. Mm-hmm. So that's how I'm sitting with truth right now. And I'm looking forward to yeah. hearing you guys go a level down from that.
Yeah. And I mean, I feel like many, many Christians think when they think of truth and when they think of what their idea of truth is or what they have in their hands that they call truth, we think it's very objective. We think that this is concrete, objective, real. Yeah. When I want to say that's probably not true. When there's no way
what
of
do you mean
proving,
by that, Randy?
When there's no way of proving something outright besides using your sacred text, it's probably fairly subjective and something that we do well to hold with some humility and hold loosely. But here's the pastoral side of me. I just want to, I know that we have listeners who are listening right now, and already your hackles are mm-hmm. straight up in the air. And you are either, if you haven't turned us off yet, you're getting ready to push that button, or you're getting ready to get real angry and you're already judging what we say. I just want to pastorally invite you into this conversation to listen from a place less from judgment, because you have this choice to make now. In this moment, you can listen from a place of being a learner and listening, or you can listen from a place of judgment. One of those will be very productive, and you might not change your mind. You might, if you sit as a learner here and say, I just want to listen to these guys because they might know things that I don't, or maybe they don't. But if you listen as a learner, you're going to actually walk out of this with integrity and with having actually listened, and maybe even your position will feel even stronger to you. The other side, if you're listening in judgment and already poking holes and getting angry and get your butt cheeks are tightened, you're not going to benefit from this conversation whatsoever.
Now I'm thinking about butt cheeks.
Sorry.
If your hackles are straight up and your butt cheeks are tight, you're going to be really uncomfortable.
Yeah, man.
Just in general, not seriously. Even with this episode.
Yeah. Take some deep breaths. So I'm just inviting you into a place of non-judgment, listening, learning, and then when you're done with this, you can think what you want to think. Mm-hmm. So Kyle, that being said, can you give us just a Cliff Notes version? I know we're talking to Professor Kyle here, Professor Whitaker. Give us a Cliff Notes version of the philosophical pursuit of truth and the philosophical view of truth.
Yeah. Okay. I do want to say that today we're recording this on November 19th, which just happens to be World Philosophy Day. So it makes me kind of happy.
I feel like you've said that before. Like,
no,
are there numerous
fact,
World Philosophy Days?
There are competing schools of thought.
Yeah.
I didn't even know there was a World Philosophy Day until today. So it made me pretty happy that we're talking about truth.
There you go.
So in a certain sense, truth is the whole point of philosophy. So we've talked about Socrates on previous episodes and the pursuit of wisdom, the pursuit of knowledge, the pursuit of the right way to live. This is what philosophy is all about. And so truth is the core concept in many ways.
Which is interesting. That's so similar to religious world.
Yeah, with an important difference. So in religious life, usually truth is attained through some kind of authority structure. So mm-hmm. if I'm a religious person, part of what that means is that my beliefs about how the world is and my beliefs about how I should be in the world and how I should treat other people is based on or derived from or at least constrained by what my religious authority tells me. The authority might be a person, might be the Pope, it might be a body of people, it might be a thousand-year tradition, it might be a text. Whatever it is, I'm constrained by authority. And truth is given to me by the authority in a way that I'm not free to then question it, right? The truth is received if you're a religious person. Okay. Or it's revealed, to use the more theological language. For philosophers, truth is discovered. Truth is a problem. Truth is something that we're ever in pursuit of. We're approaching it asymptotically. We're never actually reaching it, but that's our goal. And truth is not the sort of thing that an authority could just pronounce on, because nobody has the authority to pronounce on that. The authorities that have pronounced on it are viewed with suspicion by philosophers because they're humans too. And they're limited in all the same ways that the other humans are. And all of the other things you might view as an authority, like a text or a tradition, that can all be questioned. We can't be certain about any of it. So truth is a pursuit. It's the point of philosophy, but simultaneously it's the frustration of philosophy because it never quite works out. So I like to tell my students at the beginning of each semester, my intro philosophy students, like, everybody we're going to read in this class was wrong. In fact, they were wrong about almost everything, and we know that they were wrong. Like, Aristotle thought that the sun orbited the earth and that, you know, the stars were like self-reflecting consciousnesses and stuff.
Like everybody else.
Like everybody else.
Period of history did.
You know, and like everybody we read is mistaken, but they were mistaken in fascinating ways, and their methods for discerning truth were the best. We've not surpassed the methods. We're still tweaking some of the same methods, actually, including Aristotle's, for what it's worth. So,
which makes sense of why you philosophers are such slippery SOBs. You're really hard to nail down and give a real answer to things.
Well, because we think the real answers that you can give are always partial answers.
Yeah, they're always, no, I like that.
Reality's complicated, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And insofar as truth is the thing, and I mean, in some ways, one of the views we're going to discuss here is that truth just is reality. But insofar as truth is connected to how things really are, I mean, things are complicated. At the end of the day, we're animals. And we're animals that happen to have large brains through an accident of evolution. And grasping at the ultimate nature of things is just, it's going to take a while.
And just in case there's any listeners who immediately were triggered when Kyle said our brains are accident of evolution, I disagree with him too. Don't worry. I don't disagree with the evolution part. I disagree with the accident part.
Yeah,
but
we'll talk about that.
We'll keep going.
So, okay. So truth is said in many ways. So that was an Aristotle joke for the philosophers listening to the podcast. Aristotle famously said that the very same thing about being. Being is said in many, many senses. The same thing is true for truth. So in popular discourse, popular vernacular, how this word gets used by normal people on the street, right? It can mean anything from just whatever's out there, reality itself, the truth, right? It can mean something as simple as the opposite of a lie. Truth is simply an antonym for a lie. It can mean mere agreement. You and I agree about something and I say that's true, and that's really all I mean by it is that we agreed about it. It can be accordance with some kind of principle. It can be rhetorically, this is the way it gets used by Christians a lot, is it's whatever I find to be morally significant, an opinion that I find to be morally significant or socially significant. It's important enough to me and my community, and so I just call it truth. And that's really all it means. It's nothing deeper than that. It's not analyzed any deeper than that very often. Or, and this is the way philosophers tend to think about it, truth is a property that's had by some cognitive state, like a belief. Or it might be a property of an utterance, something that I can say, so it's a linguistic entity. Or it might be a property of a proposition, which is a thing that bears meaning, which is related to language, but also a little bit distinct. So there's all these different ways of cashing out what that means, but philosophers tend to think of truth as something cognitive that describes ideas, either in the sense of ideas that are expressed in language or maybe just ideas on their own. And the thought is, traditionally, that every idea that can be expressed in a sentence, like a declarative sentence, has a value of either true or false. And to have a value of true means Well, there's some options for what it could mean, okay? The classic view, Aristotle's view, is that it means that that idea or that sentence or whatever matches up with the world. So the classic formulation is Aristotle's. He said, to say what is true is to say of what is that it is, and to say of what is not that it is not. That's what it means to say something true. And so even for him, truth is a property of sentences, or it's a property of something that you can say. And it has to do with whether or not that sentence or that idea matches up with the world. That's the classical view. That's called correspondence. So philosophers like to talk about that theory of truth as the correspondence theory, because it's this idea that there's a world out there, and it really is a certain way, and it's independent of how we think about it. It's objective, in other words. It doesn't depend on humans. It doesn't depend on the whole consensus of rational beings. It just is the way that it is. And my representation of it in my idea or in my sentence or whatever either matches up with it or it doesn't. If it does, it corresponds and we say that it's true.
How do we make this episode required listening for our whole stinking nation right now? Right? Like post-election, one side believes one thing and the other side believes the other. Not just about the election, just so many things in our world. There's different realities, different truths, different facts, and it's
alternative facts.
Nauseating. Different facts, yeah. Yeah. I mean that doesn't make sense, but that's what, yeah.
I remember that went right after that happened, I was going to class one day, and I got on the elevator in my building, and an older guy gets on the elevator with me who turned out to be a theologian. And so in our building, theology's on the third floor and philosophy's on the fourth floor, which is the top floor. And yes, I remind the theologians of that every chance I get. And he saw me hit...
First shall be last, brother.
That's a religious idea. So he saw me hit the button for the fourth floor, so he knew I was in philosophy. He's like, so you're going to the philosophy hall? You must be a philosopher. He's like, yeah. He's like, so this must be an interesting time for you guys, what with the nature of truth and facts being questioned at every turn. And it was right after What's-Her-Face had done the alternative facts thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Which from a philosophical perspective is absolute nonsense. I mean, it's incoherent, right? Because a fact is just another way of describing the thing that my statement corresponds to. There's something out there that is a certain way. Now,
concrete,
we're totally open to the option that we might never know what it is, okay? There are many influential philosophers who have taken that view, but there's got to be a thing, and it is not guaranteed to be the way that it seems to me.
Mm-hmm. So I interrupted. You were talking about Aristotle.
Yeah, so we get this correspondence view from Aristotle. I'll just give you, as quickly as I can, a run-through of the other major options, okay, for how philosophers think about truth. Because many people are unhappy with that correspondence view for various reasons. So another way of thinking about it is truth is, it's still a property of beliefs, or it's still a property of statements or something like that. But truth, for some philosophers, is simply coherence between your beliefs. So some philosophers, like a guy named Willard Quine, for example, argued that humans, each individual human, is like a repository for a set of beliefs, okay? So we have all these beliefs about various things, and we can never really be certain if our beliefs match up with what's out there or not. Correspondence, or at least certainty about correspondence, isn't attainable. And so maybe it would be better to think of truth as the beliefs all fit together somehow. So there's like a coherent web of them, and each one kind of goes with all of the other ones. And so maybe to say that something is true just means it fits into your web in a coherent way. So that's one option. Some philosophers like that view. Another option, and this one is due to my personal favorite philosopher, a guy named Charles Peirce, who is the most original American philosopher. So this is called the pragmatic view, and this says that truth is the end of inquiry. It is the final opinion, as Peirce put it. It's where human inquiry is headed. So again, we're approaching it asymptotically. We never quite get there, but eventually all the disputes are settled. or at least that's how things have gone so far. We continue gathering evidence, we continue thinking through things, presenting the best arguments, doing, you know, all the experiments. And eventually, we come to greater and greater knowledge. So truth is simply a description of the final stage of that process, which will never actually be realized, but we're always moving towards it. And Peirce thought that it was like an obligation that we try to continue moving towards it. So that's called the pragmatic view of truth. It's something ideal out there somewhere that we're headed towards, which means we never actually possess it right now.
Yeah, very frustrating for religious people.
Very.
However, maybe fairly healthy to consider.
I mean, this is how science works, right? Scientists, when they're speaking carefully, won't say that their theories are true. When they're speaking really carefully, they might not even say that we know that various things are true, even though they're so well confirmed that they're extraordinarily unlikely to ever be overturned. They might as well be facts. Nonetheless, what happens in science is you try to disconfirm a thing until you can't anymore, and then you just treat that as though it were true until you find good reason not to. It's a very pragmatic idea. We're moving towards something, but we're always open to being overturned. So those are kind of the big three, the correspondence, the coherence, and then the pragmatic. Recently, there have been a couple other kind of popular views, but they're a little more technical, and I don't want to go into them too much, but there's one called a semantic view, which is due to a 20th century philosopher named Alfred Tarski. And he basically made truth a property of sentences that can be expressed in a very rigidly defined language. And so not a natural language, but a language that logicians actually invent. And so he made truth a kind of thing that exists within a really rigorously defined language. So his definition is very mathematical. I mean, we can be certain about it within the system, but it doesn't actually have the metaphysical implications of the other views. So in some ways, it just kind of brackets out the question of what's out there and whether or not our opinions ever actually line up with what's out there, and says instead, let's just kind of focus in on how this language is working, and we can define truth very precisely within that. And so a lot of philosophers have liked that because it's manageable, we can use it, we can make discoveries, like we can do some interesting logical work. And some of those discoveries have actually like spawned computer science. So, I mean, they're like really, really significant discoveries, but it doesn't actually tell us a whole lot about like what's out there in the world. Unless you're somebody like Willard Quine, who looked at that and said, you know what, I think that actually is the metaphysics. All it means to exist is to be describable in that language. That was his view.
Can you describe for us what you mean by what metaphysics means?
Metaphysics is simply the question of what's out there. What is being? What actually is? What actually exists? And so Quine was notoriously a reductionist about everything. He wanted to get rid of as much as possible. And so for him, only a couple of things exist. And so his notion of truth is very deflationary in the sense of we're trying to get rid of as much stuff as possible. And that's actually the last notion of truth I wanted to mention is the deflationary theory, which has various parts. But a lot of people are just kind of suspicious about whether it's even meaningful to say that anything is true. So some people want to say, for example, that if I say the sentence, it's raining outside, and then I say another sentence, it's true that it's raining outside. For a lot of philosophers, I haven't said anything different. Those sentences have exactly the same semantic content. They mean the exact same thing. I can get rid of or deflate the whole truth part altogether. So for some philosophers, truth isn't actually meaningful. It's just redundant. That's a rather
unless you live in a time like we do today, where people do say things that aren't true in bold-faced ways, right?
Yeah, so you can definitely say things according to this view that are unverifiable or that are proven to be out of sync with what is when you try to verify it. It's difficult to describe the view without using words like true and false. Mm-hmm. But they still want to say that if you say a thing is true, in addition to just stating the thing, you haven't actually said anything additional. So philosophers like that would think it would be kind of odd to aim at or seek after quote-unquote truth as a goal, because truth is just like this kind of unclear way of speaking. That isn't really necessary, that's not doing any additional work.
That sounds like a party guest that I would kind of want to stay away from.
Yeah, these would not be fun people to talk to at parties at all. But, I mean, it's quite a sizable group of philosophers that takes that view. And then I'll just mention one more, and I promise I'm done. So there's also another favorite philosopher of mine, Friedrich Nietzsche. And Nietzsche was what's called a perspectivist. And so he's famous for saying, like, little quippy things like, there is no truth, there are only perspectives. And sometimes he's misinterpreted to be a kind of relativist, but that's not really what he meant. What he meant was, at least I think what he meant was, he's kind of notoriously hard to pin down on this. If you want to, because we're all kind of limited by our own perspectives and our own social locations and our own drives and desires and motives and everything, if you really want to get as big a picture of the world as possible, you could say as accurate a picture as possible, but that kind of presupposes some things. If you want to get a little bit outside of your perspective, the only way to do it is to take up other perspectives, to dialogue with others as much as you can. And so it's kind of like if you had a partially drawn map on semi-transparent paper, and then you had another layer of semi-transparent paper that had a different part of the map on it, and then another layer, and then another, and then another, and you overlaid them all together, you could get a picture of the whole map. And so each individual represents only, you know, a partial perspective on the world. And so adding together all the perspectives will get you a better picture than you could get on your own. But he also thought there's nothing outside the perspectives. So looking for a ground to the whole thing or a God's eye view is just not possible. There's nothing outside.
Yeah. I mean, I feel and sense a lot of truth and common sense in that Nietzschean kind of way of thinking. There is no truth, only perspectives. It seems a little overly cynical to me, but... Yeah. It also reminds me, there's a contemporary philosopher named Pete Rollins out of Ireland who now lives in the U.S., but he actually has these workshops and numerous offerings, whether it's a dinner or it's called Atheism for Lent, or whether there's numerous ways in which he's trying to, I'm trying to think of the right word that he, or the word that he uses, but it's decentering practices. Mm. So us spiritual leaders would talk about centering practices. Yeah. It's good to, you know, sit here and have some centering prayer happen and calm your soul and your inner man. Pete Rollins says, I want to decenter. I want to have some decentering practices because we can't really know what we believe unless we hear from someone who has a different perspective than us. So he'll have dinners where they'll invite somebody who has the opposite view of them. And then your only job is to listen. And that person who has the opposite view will tell them everything that they believe about this thing. And they'll tell this group how I see you and how I think about the way you think and the way you believe. And you're not allowed to talk. The only thing you're able to do is ask questions.
Yeah.
And then you do this from a number of different perspectives, a number of different topics. And at the end of it, I think it's like 12 weeks or something, you kind of reflect together as a group and talk about what you learned. And really just by saying you can't really know what you believe and you can't really stand in something unless you've heard the opposite perspectives and different perspectives.
Yeah.
It sounds very challenging to me, but it sounds very healthy and just healthy.
Yeah. And we should have him on the podcast. I think that would be interesting.
I think we will. Yeah.
He's a big fan of Nietzsche. So that's probably where he's getting it. So he's involved in what's called the death of God movement or death of God theology, which is straight from Nietzsche. Nietzsche's most famous for his proclamation that God is dead, which is doesn't mean what you think it means. Various philosophers have described being informed, having their faith informed by Nietzsche in a healthy way. I would be in that group of people. Nietzsche certainly was no Christian. He was no fan to no friend to Christianity, but his critiques of religion and particularly the religious perspective on truth is helpful. Can be very helpful. So I just said a lot of stuff about about truth. There's a lot going on there. The upshot, okay? Here's my what I think the upshot is for our audience anyway. Philosophers don't know what truth is, and we're the group of people most interested in it in the world, at least as interested in it as religious people have ever been. And we're the group of people, and this might sound arrogant, but we're the group of people most capable of figuring it out. We've literally spent thousands arrogant. Of years on the
you
question.
You think that sounds arrogant?
I mean, I say that because we're the group of people that's trained specifically to deal with questions like that. Yes. And we have reached nothing even close to a consensus. So there are pockets of people who take all the views that I just described There are pockets of people who try to create hybrids out of them. Personally, I subscribe to a pragmatic view. I think that's a good way to go. But there are problems with all of these. And in many cases, trying to get clear logically on what truth is often leads you into paradox. So there are very famous paradoxes that philosophers and logicians who work on truth try to sort out, and it's very hard. So the upshot for me is, we don't know what truth is, ergo, you don't know what truth is. Humans don't know what truth is. That's kind of the bottom line for philosophers. Now, let me say this much, okay, and then I'll turn it back over. There's nothing whatsoever wrong with believing that you are correct about how you see the world. In fact, it would be weird not to. Like, to have a belief implies, usually, there are exceptions, but usually to have a belief implies that you think the world is a certain way.
Yeah, you think it's true.
Yeah, everybody thinks their perspective is correct. Everybody thinks their beliefs are true, and that's perfectly natural and good. That's as it should be. And people ought to defend their views, and you ought not to give up a belief if you don't have good reason to do so. Every philosopher I know would agree with that. Mm-hmm. It's just that no one has ownership of the concept, and no one can actually explicate the concept in a way that's convincing to other smart people.
And when the church has, you know, got some real eggs on its face, or when the church has thought something is true so strongly that they're willing to burn people at the stake because they have a different perspective.
Well, you can understand why they thought that, right? If your idea of truth is that this is a thing that we received from God, so it's, and it's almost, you can think of it as a kind of humility. I think it would be a warped sense of humility. It's not a humility that I would recommend as a virtue. But burning someone at the stake or condemning someone or, you know, excommunicating someone or whatever was in a way an expression of humility in the sense of, who am I to say what is true? The tradition has given this to me. And by the lights of the tradition, you're outside of it. And the tradition has also told me what to do about that. It's a kind of obedience. It's an obedience that a philosopher would never see the virtue in. But from a religious perspective, you can kind of understand the perspective.
So if I'm someone with faith and I believe that I know something of God or even heard something directly from God, is that where I should be stopping? Or do I layer on this supreme human philosophical wisdom that makes it so that you can say there is none who knows truth? And I guess as someone of faith, which lens am I supposed to look through?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, my recommendation, and it's simply that, because you got to do what you got to do, right? I mean, you're responsible for shepherding your own beliefs, but I would say test yourself to see how sure you are, to see how confident you are. Do you really know that? And there are ways of testing yourself, and the easiest way is to ask other people. and we can work together to find out if you're actually sure about that. And I bet, give us a few minutes or maybe a few hours, and I bet I could get you to doubt it. But if I can't, if that fails, if we go through the process and you don't doubt it at the end of the day, you're absolutely sure about it, as sure as you are of anything, then who are we to say that that's not the case?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think at the very least, we do well to be more careful with the word truth as Christians, as religious people. Yeah.
Yeah. You get no argument from me there. So let's flip this around. So I just gave you that probably annoyingly nerdy take on what philosophers think about this. What's it like from your perspective? So how do you think about truth? How do you communicate the idea of truth in your position as a pastor?
Yeah. It's interesting. You're going to get a different take from me than you would many, many other Christian pastors, because I grew up in that world that felt like we knew what truth was, and we've cornered the market on truth, and that's in regards to end times theology and eschatology. It's in regards to sexuality. It's in regards to who's in and who's out. That's in regards to science and creationism. That's in regards to everything, right? But it's been a long time since I've thought like that. I got quickly weirded out, even before I was a pastor, by the way that Christians used the word truth so willy-nilly and so in such a weaponized fashion, I would say. I get very skeptical of it pretty early on. And now I'm just not one of those pastors that you'd hear talking about truth a lot. And some people don't like me for it. Some people probably have left our church because of it. And some, you know, I just had this conversation literally a couple of weeks ago, a person who is considering leaving our church. And his first question was, do you believe in absolute truth? I was like, oh, here we go. All right, it's that kind of conversation. And his question was, he asked the question because he doesn't hear me talk about absolute truth so much. And so maybe that means that Pastor Randy doesn't believe it. Yeah. And very few people call me Pastor Randy, by the way.
The Reverend.
I bet there's a Venn diagram of the people that do and the people that use the phrase absolute truth.
Yeah, sure. Well, no, most of the people who use the phrase absolute truth are pretty questionable about whether I'm qualified to be a pastor or not. And what I told him was, you know, I probably believe in absolute truth, but it's not the scriptures. And he didn't love that. But so I'll go to where I think truth lies and then kind of unpack it from there. But when I talk about truth, I'm talking about a person. And I know that freaks you philosophers out, but that's just my take and where I am right now, where I've been for a while, and what I'm most comfortable with. I'm uncomfortable with talking about anything as absolute truth unless you're talking about the person of Christ. And then I can say truth is found in Christ. And I can say that because, A, everything that I've seen or heard from Christ in the Christian scriptures resonates in such a dynamic way in me, in such a deep way that is elevated above anything, both in the scriptures and anything that I've heard. The person of Christ is something and someone who continues to make sense of things and to make sense of reality. And I feel like the further I get away from the person of Christ, the more unraveled I get, and the closer and closer and more connected I am to this person of Christ, both in my thought life and my soul and my devotional life, the more centered and real I feel, the more grounded in reality I feel. And I think the most inspired portions of the scriptures by far are the ones that speak to Jesus as truth. Ones like John 1, where it talks about the divine logos, the divine word of God that was before all things, and all things were created through this word, through Jesus. And John even says, we received the law through Moses, but we received grace and truth through Jesus. Now that, I mean, most of us just walk right by that, but do you realize what John is saying when he said that? He's saying that we didn't get the truth from Moses, right? Like the Old Testament, the Hebrew scriptures, weren't this fullest embodiment of truth. He says, we didn't get truth until we got Jesus. That's profound. And then I fast forward to Colossians 1, where the Apostle Paul said that Jesus is the image of the invisible God. So the Apostle Paul got something. He got that, like, this God that we believe in, that we put our faith and trust in and are giving ourselves to, he's invisible. She's invisible. This divine life is invisible. We're, that's why it's called faith. We can't know. But we have this human one who we believe was fully divine and fully human. And this one named Jesus, the Christ, is the fullest expression of the divine life that we will ever have in this life. And that if we've seen Jesus, we've seen God. And so that just tells me that's the one thing I can have confidence in talking about truth, that truth is a person. And Jesus even said it himself, for crying out loud. He said, I am the way, and I am the truth, and I'm the life. I am the truth. I'm very comfortable with that statement because it's so complex, but yet it's so simple. You know, you're not able to reduce truth down into a formulaic system of bullet points. Mm-hmm. You actually have to observe and become a disciple of and give yourself to a person. And you have to listen, and you have to lay aside your judgments and your preconceived notions about what reality is, what truth is, and you just become a learner of this one who defied the religious leaders of his day, who was killed by the religious leaders of his day, who was killed by the empire, the greatest empire the world that was in the world at that point, and yet was probably the most, has become the most followed and respected person who's ever walked planet Earth that we know of. So that's my perspective on truth. And I get very uncomfortable if we go somewhere outside of that. I can't stomach those conversations that makes truth out to be something that it's not. And I know, again, philosophers, I know that you're saying, well, that's what you're doing when you're talking about Jesus' truth. That's fine. We can disagree, but that person, that life is where I found the most truth of anything and anyone.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like one thing you're both sharing is that there's this idea of some external thing that we won't attain or know, and we can't say that we've got it.
Nope.
It's outside of us, and we journey towards it continually.
Yeah. If truth is a person, as in Christ, and in by Christ, I mean, I'm a Trinitarian Christian, so I believe in Father, Son, and Spirit. I believe in this relational God, that this relational divine life that together they represent and make up who is God. And I believe that that divine life is the ground of being of all reality. And so when I talk about truth as a person, that's what I'm talking about, that the ground of being of all reality actually has been revealed in a person who is Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. And I'll spend my life journeying towards truth, that whose name is Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah. For all I said about those perspectives on truth from, you know, different philosophers, I think everything you said could be consistent with most of those theories. So for a correspondence, for example, I mean, the thing that's out there that our statements are trying to correspond to might be Jesus. it might be what Kant called the thing in itself, the noumenal world. It might be what Peirce called the, he had another name for it. I can't think.
Thing in itself, is that I am that I am?
I mean, we could interpret it that way, right? So the
it's kind of
Kant explicitly had God in mind, because he wanted to make the case that humans weren't capable of knowledge of God. We weren't capable of knowledge of many things, but God is one of the things, because God is understood in classical philosophy as the source of being. God is the primordially existing thing from which all other things spring, and we are limited by our own cognitive filters, and we just can't access that. That was his view.
It reminds me of the way you talked about an Anselmic way of describing God, or a case for God, right?
Yeah, God's the necessarily existing thing, or the self-existent thing, or whatever. And from our perspective, I mean, what's the difference between saying that that's Jesus or the Christ, or saying that that's, I don't know, the one, if you take the view of Plotinus, or if you're a Buddhist, it's the universe, or it's the eternal flux, or whatever. I mean, all those descriptions are semantically equivalent from the perspective of a correspondence theorist. So it's an article of faith to say that it's Jesus, but a lot of philosophers are fine with that. Yeah, or if you're a pragmatist about truth like I am, then, you know, to say that Jesus is the truth in a kind of, I don't know, really general sense might mean something like we're gradually, as a human race, or as a race of rational beings, maybe bigger than humanity, we're gradually heading towards a perspective of the world where Jesus' nature will be more and more realized, or at least our understanding of the world will get closer and closer to that kind of nature. I'm okay with that. I personally, when I read that part in John about Jesus being the way, the truth, and the life, I interpret it ethically. I don't think that Jesus was trying to make a metaphysical statement to, or I don't think John was trying to make a metaphysical statement to satisfy the Greek philosophers, but he's the way for me to become fully human. He's the life for me as a human, and he's the truth in the sense of he's the thing that I should aim all of my religious beliefs at, and all of the things that I believe about how I should treat other people. I interpret it in a kind of ethical sense, but I don't think it's necessarily doing damage to the text or to the Christian view to treat it as more than that. Mm-hmm. And many Christian philosophers have said that whatever reality is, it's Christ.
Mm-hmm.
It's in ways that we don't understand. It's mysterious, but He's the primordial thing, you know?
And it's fun to me that on this journey towards truth, because that's what I would, that's how I would describe a real religious journey, and particularly for me, a Christian journey, is a journey towards truth. So I'm journeying towards that which is real. I'm journeying towards that which is the foundational reality of the of the cosmos, of existence, of reality. But while I do that, I feel like the closer I get, the more I don't know.
Yeah.
And that's super fun to me. That's, you know, this idea of wonder and mystery.
Yeah.
I feel like the further we go on this journey towards truth, if we do it in a humble and, you know, authentic kind of way, ironically, the more we understand how much we don't understand and how far from that foundational ground of reality that is the divine life, that is Christ,
mm-hmm.
which just thrills me. I actually love that. That's a spiritual journey that I can say yes and amen to, is one that is open to wonder, journeying towards truth. And the further you go, the more that you realize you don't know.
Yeah. So was your friend happy with any of that when you explained your...
Well, no, I mean, that conversation went the way a lot of these conversations go, is I just ask a lot of questions, because Jesus, if you take Jesus out of the scriptures, it's easier to have a formulaic form of Christianity, right? But because of Jesus, we have to get comfortable with all sorts of nuance. And so that conversation went, like, because of the absolute truth foundation, then it went to, do you think there's a clear-cut way to get into heaven or to have eternal life, you know? And I was like, well, I'm not qualified to give that answer, but the one who is walked on planet Earth and gave a number of different ways, seemingly, to have life, to have access to that life. Sometimes it looked like faith and belief. Sometimes it looked like caring for the least of these. Sometimes it looked like you would do all sorts of things in Jesus' name, and still he would say, depart from me, for I never knew you. And so I think just using Jesus' words, actually the red letters in the Bible, is just, it's hard to get around in these conversations. You have to build a Christless theology in some ways to come to these hard, fast truths, to be totally honest, if I'm just going to be, that was offensive,
whoa,
what I just said, but.
So, wow, so a thoroughly biblical theology would entail for you a Christless theology.
I didn't say biblical.
Fair? Well, but that's where they're getting it from, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
the truth is what the Bible says, which is obvious.
Yes, I would say many modern Protestant Christians have a shockingly small amount of Jesus in their functional theology.
Mm.
Let me say that, yeah. And I would say most of their theology is based on the Apostle Paul, who would disagree with most of their theology. But when you bring up Jesus to a lot of Protestant Christians, you're actually challenging their theology, because they formulated a theology that's very formulaic and very, you know, A plus B equals C. And it's just Jesus breaks those categories. Jesus comes along and brings the gray in, and he brings even more gray when you get more uncomfortable with it. It's why the religious people kill Jesus.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like God is a person and not a mathematical theorem.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This could be so much more simple, right? Like this, this Christian journey could be just so cut and dry, and so many American Christians would love it if it was, you know, because we turn the Bible into a manual or to a textbook and turn all our theology into formulas. And that's just, Jesus comes along and disappoints you at every turn if you have that that viewpoint. It's why we can't really focus too much on Jesus if that's the way we want to think.
Mm, yeah.
Friends, before we continue, we want to thank Storyhill BKC for their support. Storyhill BKC is a full menu restaurant, and their food is seriously some of the best in Milwaukee. On top of that, Storyhill BKC is a full-service liquor store featuring growlers of tap available to go, spirits, especially whiskeys and bourbons, thoughtfully curated regional craft beers, and 375 selections of wine. Visit StoryhillBKC.com for menu and more info. If you're in Milwaukee, you'll thank yourself for visiting Storyhill BKC, and if you're not, remember to support local. One more time, that's StoryhillBKC.com.
So what do you think Christians mean when they use that phrase, absolute truth? I've never quite got my head around that. I mean, I used to be super into apologetics, and we'd throw that phrase around all the time. But I'm not, to this day, I'm still not really clear what we meant by it.
Like, when I think about sexuality is when it kind of crystallizes for me. And I think when they say absolute truth, they mean something that cannot be argued with, mm-hmm. something that is from God, is true eternally, and it doesn't matter what cultural context you find yourself in, it doesn't matter what science or logic say, this is absolute truth, and that's the end of the conversation. So if I have a son or a daughter who's gay, I know absolute truth, and absolute truth says I've got to fix them. Or I know absolute truth, and absolute truth means that experience is wrong, and we got to figure them out. We got to psychoanalyze and, you know, Jesusize them, because absolute truth is very clear. Absolute truth allows for no wiggle room. Is that about right when it comes to absolute truth? What we mean?
Yeah, it's the opposite of the relativistic. Like, mm-hmm. You believe what you want, I'll believe what I want, and we'll all be okay. It's like, no, these things you must.
Yep.
They're true whether or not you see them as true.
Exactly.
Well, I guess I'm trying to get clear on what the absolute part adds to it. So it just sounds redundant to me. If a thing is true,
totally,
then it's true. So what does it mean? I mean, if the absolute part is, as you said, can't be argued with, surely they mean shouldn't be argued with. Or do they really mean can't?
Yeah. To which you say, watch me.
I mean, like, if you go outside occasionally and talk to people, you would hopefully view that there's anything that can't be argued.
I'm trying to get inside of the head of my friend who I'm talking about this conversation from several weeks ago. And I think he would say, there are things in the Christian faith and in the church that we can disagree about, the non-essentials, if you will. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. We can actually still be friends and fellowship as Christian brothers and sisters and disagree on those things. But there is absolute truth. There are the essentials that cannot be compromised, we cannot be wishy-washy about, we cannot allow for disagreement about, because if we disagree, those things are absolutely true, and there is no wiggle room there. Then we have to break fellowship. Then we have to say, you're not a Christian anymore. Then we have to say, you're wrong, because this is absolute truth.
Mm-hmm. But again, what they mean by that must be, functionally, what I think is true.
Doesn't matter to them. What the scriptures say is what matters.
There are a lot of things I think are true, but the absolute truths, if I'm taking on this mindset, are the things on which I cannot tolerate your disagreement and still see you within the camp that I'm in.
Yeah, so just the most important ones.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Okay, so absolute truth means the things I think are most important.
I'm like getting uncomfortable, like I have to defend this.
Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to get clear on the idea. I mean, it's an idea that I guess I used to hold. I just don't remember. I'm just trying
it's the things that
think
we cannot,
as these people think.
The things that we cannot compromise on, the things that if our culture tells us some person has their own truth and you have your own truth,
that's actually wrong. So if it's that, that's a consequentialist thing, which means... If the justification for this being the absolute truth is that if I don't treat it that way, then really terrible stuff will happen, then that's not truth. We're not talking about truth anymore, right? Because now that depends on what I do, and so it's just not truth anymore. So it can't be, what they mean cannot be, at least as far as I can understand it, that this is something that if we don't treat it as true, then terrible things will happen. Because then its nature as truth somehow depends on me, or its importance depends on me. That wouldn't make any sense. So to say that something is quote unquote absolute truth has to mean something else. And as the clearest I can see on it is that it means what I or my community says is most important.
Well, yeah, and what they think is absolutely true or absolute truth is the grounds for human flourishing. They would say the reason that our world is the way it is because the world is relativistic and hates absolute truth. Mm-hmm. If we had absolute truth, we'd have strong nuclear families. Our world believed in absolute truth, we would have a flourishing economy, and freedom would be what it was meant to be. If we had absolute truth, we wouldn't have all these people coming out as transgender and mm-hmm. gender confusion and all that stuff, because we've gone so far in this relativistic, you know, truth-hating culture that we live in that we've got what we deserve.
Sure, yeah, but even there, those things are evidence to you of people having given up on truth because you have an idea of what human flourishing looks like. And if you're getting that idea from somewhere, you're either getting it from something external to your faith, in which case you're in the same boat as the rest of us, you're just a hypocrite about it, or you're getting it from the Bible, in which case your view is circular, or you're getting it from your tradition, which is still just a circular. So,
and what do you mean by circular?
It's kind of like when somebody says, you should believe the Bible, and I say, why? And they say, because the Bible says so.
Because it's the Bible.
Yeah, I mean, if I think that not grasping absolute truth will lead you to unhappiness or will prevent your flourishing as a human being, but my notion of absolute truth is derived from my own opinions or the tradition of which I'm a part, and I say, well, why is that the correct notion of human flourishing? And the answer is because the tradition says it. Like, you can't give a demonstrable justification for that view of...
It's basically, in my world, I equate that to being a fan. It's like sports. I would say a person would ask me, who's the best... A kid would ask me, who's the best football team? And I'd be like, duh, the Packers.
Yeah.
And they'd be like, why are the Packers the best? I could give them all sorts of reasons why because we have these amazing quarterbacks and, you know, tradition and we do things right. But at the end of the day, why are the Packers the best team? Because they're the Packers. Yeah. What does that mean? They're just the Packers. They're the best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess that's what confuses me about the whole phrase and why we spend so much time on it now is that, I mean, I'm fine with sticking to a tradition, saying, you know, this is how we think about things, and we have our coherent system, and it makes sense to us. It's internally consistent, and we think it provides a good path to flourishing. And if you disagree, then you're just not part of our system, but that's fine. But, like, adding the absolute truth part to it makes it sound like you think it's bigger than your system, which makes it sound like you think it's demonstrable, which means you should be able to demonstrate it, or somebody should be able to demonstrate it. So it's weird that it just reduces back to, like, when you dig into it, it just reduces back to, well, this is what our group said.
Any of our listeners who could explain this to us better than we're seeming to be able to grasp it should just email us. Because
I tried to
look back on Google Trends. They only go back as far as 2004, but it looks like absolute truth has peaked sometime before that because it was already trending down. Mm. That's as far back as they go. But my guess is that it was the Christian response to postmodernism as a movement. You've got postmodernism that comes in and starts to talk about things like multiple truths. And so then there's this response on the part of Christianity where you have to, well, no, there's not multiple truths. But there are absolutes. These are things that would be my guess. I'd love to hear if somebody could school us on this.
I mean, this is, you know, I condemn cynicism, but I'm pretty cynical. I want to say this is part of the reason why we see so many people walking away from the faith, from Christianity, is because we're obsessed with little weird, you know, cult-like ideas like absolute truth. Like that, we just don't have to obsess over that and talk about it ad nauseum because it's just not helping us, I would say. Let me ask you this, Kyle. As someone who grew up in the church, and you said, you know, in the very beginning of this podcast that you grew up as a fundamentalist in many ways, and as someone who was passionate about apologetics up until, you know, inside of this last decade, which is the ultimate irony, I think, and as somebody who still identifies as a Christ follower, how would you recommend that we who identify as Christians, because I sure hope there's some non-Christians and some atheists and some other faiths listening, but how would you recommend that we Christians think and talk about truth?
Do it less.
Okay, there's a good start.
I mean, listen to experts, people that know what they're talking about. Don't take a concept that's extensively, exhaustively studied in some other area and then, like, co-opt it and claim ownership of it and, like, give it a kind of parochial definition and then insist that that be the definition for everyone else. It's not a way to, like, win friends and influence people, you know what I mean? I don't know. Like, maybe it's my apologetics days jaded me for the whole Christian use of the concept, but what we meant by it back then was the ability to clobber somebody in an argument. That's what truth was, to vindicate your position. And I don't see that as a Christian idea anymore. In fact, I see it as a sinful idea, more often than not. So I'd like to see less emphasis on truth and more emphasis on love, personally. Not that there's not room for a robust notion of truth within Christianity. I think there is, but I think maybe the church would be well served by spending a generation or so just trying to put truth on the back burner for a while and focus on love a bit more. I mean, if you think reality is one thing, then, and you think that thing is love and you think that thing is truth, then either one should get you there. So let's just focus on love a bit and see where we end up with the truth. I mean, that would be my hope for the church. But I don't know. For me, the focus of the Christian life should be on being as faithful and as loving as possible. But I think both faith and love have a kind of rocky relationship with truth in the way that it's often practiced in the church and has been practiced. And I don't just mean evangelicals either. I mean orthodoxy in general. I mean the idea that religious people have ownership of understanding reality. That seems to me in tension with both faith and love, which are supposed to be humble things. And I don't see a lot of humility in that sense of ownership. Even if we think, as any good Catholic would, that truth is a gift of God somehow, nonetheless, I'm still a fallible human who's trying to interpret it the best I can alongside other fallible humans who don't see it the way that I do. So,
yeah. And just in case there's any good, wonderful Christians who are, again, getting a little angsty right now, I'm just going to encourage you, with keeping in mind what you just heard from Kyle, stop your car, stop cutting your grass, whatever you're doing, and on your phone, go turn to 1 Corinthians 13 and read that through and then see what you think.
Yeah, I don't see Paul talking that much about being able to, I don't know, vindicate your view. He definitely argues a lot, okay? So to be fair, he definitely likes to win arguments, but it's definitely all in the service of getting people to love each other better, to be more faithful. So I don't know. I just want to advocate for more humility and less confidence that we possess the truth. It's okay to think that you know what's correct. It's okay to try to convince other people about it if you do so in an honest way and in a way that preserves the dignity of the other person. Which a lot of times we don't, but to think that you possess it, that it's your thing, that's a problem.
Yeah. So this is getting at something that, an idea and a concept that I think I'm quite certain you introduced me to, that I'm really, really a huge fan of now, which is this idea of epistemic humility. Mm-hmm. Epistemic being like how we know what we know. Right.
Yeah.
Being humble about what we know, epistemic humility. I think Christians would do very well to acquaint ourselves with this idea of epistemic humility. So Kyle, can you just unpack just a little bit more again for us the concept of epistemic humility and why it might be a virtue in this day and age?
Yeah, I mean, it's regular humility applied to what you know. So regular humility is a virtue. You're putting the interests of others ahead of your own, but you're also not denying or downplaying or deprecating your own interests. You're simply focused on the good of others. That's your fundamental orientation. And now apply that to knowledge. Well, I'm focused on learning from others. I'm focused on building something together with a community of people because I think we're better together than we are as individuals. So in a way, it's just the opposite of overconfidence. It's the opposite of going it alone, being sort of a lone crusader and figuring things out. So actually, I wrote a blog a little while ago where I talked a little bit about this. So I give a description in there.
How very like early 2000s of
I know, time. Right? Yeah. So I give a description in there of an epistemically humble person that I just want to read for you, if that's okay. It's just a couple of paragraphs. So I say, the epistemically humble person will know both her own limitations and her strengths, how important it is to rely on others for what she knows. She'll be focused on learning from experts and on making a genuine contribution rather than appearing to make a contribution. She'll recognize that her own opinions are not obviously true and will understand that disagreement itself is evidence of this. She'll be quick to say, "I don't know," when she doesn't know. She won't succumb to the pressure to pretend that she knows or to excuse her ignorance by redirecting attention to all the things that she does know. And moreover, she will readily change her mind when presented with new evidence, which tips the scales in another direction. And she won't pretend that she didn't change her mind, or pay lip service to the pernicious idea that changing one's mind is a defect. When dealing with others who believe differently, she will remember what it's like to hold a different view, and will try to be grateful for those people who listened to her and helped her then. She will keep in mind that people often have bad introductions to ideas, and will try to find out how they understand what's at stake before launching a counterattack. The humble person will present her opinions when it is appropriate to present them, such as when people ask, or when she is an expert, or when she can highlight a point made by someone else that went unnoticed, or when she's aware of being able to articulate an important point clearly. And this is important, she will present her opinions with her level of confidence. So I believe this, but I'm not certain about it for the following reasons. And she'll know when not to have an opinion, and will be comfortable saying, I don't have enough information to take a position on that. And finally, I say, this is the end of it, she will make her arguments and assertions unapologetically, without condescension, but also without pretense or embarrassment. Because I think a part of humility is having an accurate self-understanding. I know my limits, but I also know my strengths, and I don't try to present them as anything other than what they are.
Yep. All that sounds fantastic, but makes for a really bad preacher. People now, like certainty.
You're joking, but we could really dig into that.
Yeah, I want to dig on that a little bit.
Yeah. So we've already recorded an episode with another philosopher where we kind of dive into this a bit, and we haven't released it yet at the time of this recording. But this is important. I mean, there is a sense in which evangelizing, or not even just evangelizing, but exhorting people to faith, which is part of the job of a pastor. I don't want to say that it can't be done humbly. I think it can, and I think you model that pretty well usually. But it lends itself to overconfidence. You kind of have to... I remember, so I used to, back when I was doing my apologetic stuff, I would go and speak places sometimes about that stuff. And a buddy of mine who was kind of my mentor, also really into that, he's giving me some advice on how to do it one time, and he said, when you walk into a room, you decide the room is yours, and you own it.
Yeah.
You own the audience. And then when you walk out of the room, you give them back. And you have to, like, very intentionally do that. And so I kind of trained myself to do that, and it's really easy to forget the second part. And I think pastors are in a hard position because they have to speak in a way that's exhorting and upbuilding, but they also have to speak in a way that's humble and that doesn't let on that they know more than they do. And that's a hard road to walk, which is why I don't think everybody should do it.
Is it possible, Kyle, to have real faith in something, in the divine, while holding that faith with epistemic humility? You described a lot within, you know, quoting your blog post, but what does that look like? Where have you seen it in a person? And what does that look like? What's the flavors?
Yeah, it's definitely possible. I mean, I think you successfully do it most of the time. I think I've been actually blessed to be surrounded by people who are a lot better at faith than I am for most of my life. And I've seen really good examples of humility. It's like C.S. Lewis said, when you're around a humble person, you probably don't really remember it, probably doesn't stick in your brain very well, because they were probably just good conversationalists. They probably just were interested in you. I've definitely seen a lot of really great examples of that. I mean, I think it just looks like presenting your confidence and presenting your doubt transparently. And never pretending. I mean, pretense is the opposite of humility. So, and anybody can do that. You can do it about anything. I can pretend to know more than I do about theories of truth. I can pretend to know more than I do about how to be a faithful Christian.
And I think that's what you just said there, talking about what being confident about what you believe and being honest about what you doubt. I think that's why this conversation, one of the reasons why this conversation has gotten so difficult and so needed in the church, is because of this, what we've talked about before, the idol of certainty in the church. That it's for, for any Christian to have doubt or uncertainty about something as it goes with their faith journey, theology, what have you, that's a scary and dirty place to be. You're not allowed to do that in a lot of the church. I mean, our church, you are allowed to do that, but I remember talking to someone who's from our church network, and I talked about how we're going through Ecclesiastes at this point, and we're talking about doubt and uncertainty and faith crises and giving faith space for that, and he was blown away that we would be talking about this. You know, he lives in the Bible Belt, where it's especially, you know, profane to admit any doubt or uncertainty, but the church has replaced, I think, much of the Christian church has replaced faith with certainty. And really, we can't get it through our heads that those are opposing concepts, that one doesn't match with the other. It's just not the fact. And the Apostle Paul, let's go back to the Apostle Paul, maybe someone who we on the other side of this conversation would like to quote more than anybody. The Apostle Paul didn't say certainty in the reality of Christ will save you. The Apostle Paul said faith, and even in the Greek translation, it's faithfulness to the way of Christ is what saves you, if anything does. And that's just diametrically opposed to this idea of being certain, of not having any doubt, of knowing. Why, how did we get to this place where we replaced faith and belief with certainty and knowing? And by knowing, I mean a very silly sense of knowing.
Yeah, that's a question for a historian. I think we could do a whole episode on that. We should definitely probably have one on the podcast. I mean, I think the answer, whatever it is, would be pretty frustrating. I mean, in my experience with the Holy Spirit, certainty or even confidence about propositions has really never been even part of the interaction. It's the Holy Spirit has only ever led me away from that, if I'm frank. And so I have a hard time, and I know that this is, I have really good Catholic friends that I respect a great deal, and I have friends who are parts of other traditions who would take a similar view as the one I'm about to critique, but I have a really hard time thinking that orthodoxy was the result of the leading of the Holy Spirit, that battening down the hatches about what's true was the result of following God. That's a huge thing to say, and probably not a very humble thing to say, because I'm one little guy in this long tradition of Christians trying their best. And I think most of those people were probably trying their best, and they were sincere, and I'm sure they heard from the Holy Spirit. But in my interactions, and that's all I can speak to, that's just not what she does. She leads me to serving people, particular people in my sphere. And I'd like to be a fly on the wall in some of those ecumenical councils, just to see how often and if ever the point was raised, is this actually what we should be doing? And is this in service of particular people that we can name? Again, that's a question for a historian. Maybe it was.
Yep. So, friends, if you're still with us, if particularly you friends who were getting a little bit insecure and, you know, angry during the beginning of this episode, if you're still hanging with us, if you're still here, I just want to say maybe that same spirit that Kyle was just speaking to is offering us an invitation out of a prideful religion that's built on pretense and into a never-ending journey towards truth that we'll never fully wrap our hands around and our heads around and our hearts and our spirits around, but we're never going to stop journeying towards truth. We're never going to stop journeying towards that which is real. We're never going to stop journeying towards Christ, and it's going to be the best, most beautiful journey that we could ever go on. It's going to be painful. It's going to be, you know, there's going to be grief in it. There's going to be disappointment along the way. But the whole time, even in our grief, we're going to be invited into truth. Even in our pain, And even in our wrestlings, even in our longings, we're going to find truth there because we're going to find Christ in those places. And so maybe we're just being invited into a different way of holding and looking at and walking with our faith that is a lot more appealing to both yourself when it comes down to it and to the people around you, and actually seems a little bit more Christ-like in the way we find it in the Gospels.
Thanks for spending this time with us. We really hope that you're enjoying these conversations as much as we are. And if you are, help us get the word out. Before you close your podcast app, leave a rating or a review. That helps new listeners find us, maybe for the first time. If you'd like to share the episode you just heard with a friend or a family member, you can find those links on our social media pages. You can also find us over on Patreon at patreon.com/apastorandaphilosopher. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, this has been A Pastor and a Philosopher. Walk into a bar.